The format of today's meeting will be very structured. As this is a public meeting, it is not a public hearing. The public hearing was held at the Wetlands Board meeting. So the schedule today will be the staff brief and synopsis of the board record will be allotted 30 minutes. The appellants will be allotted 30 minutes. The local Wetlands Board Council argument will be 30 minutes. Those individuals who spoke at the Wetlands Board in order to perfect standing or to clarify or verify what you said on the record at the Wetlands Board will be allowed to speak for a cumulative amount of 30 minutes. The appellant's summary and rebuttal will be 10 to 15 minutes, and the commission discussion, questions, and actions will be whatever it takes. This will be timed, and when your time is up, your time is up. So we want to keep it as close to that as we possibly can. We really appreciate your cooperation. So the first item, unless there's any other housekeeping business, would be Mr. Grab. Yeah, I need to do that. That's absolutely correct. The staff that will testify today, or maybe testify, would you please stand? Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony that you'll give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God. Thank you. Mr. Worrell.
Good morning, Commissioner Bowman and members of the commission.
Morning, sir.
We have a commission review on appeal by the applicant, Sandler at Indigo Bay, of the May 21st, 2007 decision by the City of Virginia Beach Board to deny a proposal to fill and impact approximately 2 acres of tidal wetlands associated with the construction of a 1,063-unit multi-residential community on property situated along Pleasure House Creek in the Ocean Park subdivision of Virginia Beach. Now, I'm going to try and summarize in about 20 minutes what took approximately 5 hours. So if I'm moving too quickly or if you have questions you'd like me to slow down, please let me know.
Okay. And for the record, the commission members have had the entire transcript for better than 3 weeks, so we have all had an opportunity to go over numerous times the actual transcript of the record.
Yes, sir.
Continue.
After the May Wetlands hearing, the applicant's attorney, John Daniel, submitted a letter of appeal in a timely fashion to the commission. A hearing was set for June 27th, but the applicant's attorney then requested a continuance for July. That was granted, and all parties were notified. The appeal requested that the commission reverse the decision because the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities and the applicant's rights were prejudiced by the errors of the board. The attorney's letter, however, did not specifically mention how this had occurred. We'd like to start by showing a few aerials. I would like to note staff does not consider this opening the record. It's just to give commission members perspective of the site. It's one of the better aerials we have. Showing the subject parcel here in relation to the Lynn Haven Inlet. Here's the Lesnar Bridge, Chesapeake Bay. This is the Virginia Beach Boat Ramp Facility on Crab Creek. And, of course, this is Pleasure House Creek. It's another aerial looking towards the east. Here's the subject parcel. Looking back to the west, the parcel does wrap all the way along. I think this is Marlin Bay Drive, back to Shore Drive. One more aerial looking south, and one last aerial looking towards the west. This shows the entire eastern side of the subject parcel. The property does include both tidal and non-tidal wetlands and has an extensive history related to the Lynn Haven Inlet dredging and spoils placement. Although the majority of the property on Pleasure House Creek side has in the past been filled with dredge materials, the canals and ditches that were excavated to aid in the dewatering of the site now contain fringing wetlands. Therefore, tidal wetlands exist inside portions of the property well landward of the tidal marsh situated along the shoreline of Pleasure House Creek. Now I'm going to go through the presentation the city provided. And it's worth noting that there are numerous slides here taken from the application and photographs. The city staff didn't actually present any briefing along with the slides. They went through them very quickly. However, I will note with especially the plan view drawings, the impacts, and highlight those as we go through. And we'll try to go through rather quickly, though. And this is all taken from the application, the drawings. The subject property with the vicinity map. The entire project is impacted. You see color-coded impacts, and I'll get into those a little more specifically. When the city put this together, showing the individual pages that were taken from the joint permit application, and of course we see the colors. To go ahead and give you an idea, Red denotes wetlands impacts, green proposed wetlands, purple existing open water, and blue proposed water basins. This is the first plan view as we're starting out on the western side, moving around towards the east. As you see here, the only impact that, well, what's shown in green is proposed tidal created wetlands. What's in the board's jurisdiction here are the oyster shell reefs that are shown here, and there is one tidal channel that basically would pop through the fringe wetlands to allow for flushing and tidal interaction of these wetlands. On the second page, again, we see the oyster reefs. I don't see any proposed wetlands impacts in the board's jurisdiction here. It's just a basin to be reconfigured. Now we're starting to get into the jurisdiction of the Wetlands Board. Along the edges of these existing canals, you may see a red color and also some of the reds around the edges here. These are impacts to the wetlands, which a portion are jurisdictional, a portion are not. And they are specified throughout the appendix in the application. But essentially what's happening here, these two tidal canals will be filled to allow for this development. New wetlands will be created in green along with new basins. And there are a couple of channel pop-throughs right in here to allow the mitigation areas to thrive. Again, we have another tidal canal. Green is proposed mitigation. Pipes to be removed here to allow more tidal interaction. In the red, these are wetland impacts, but not within the board's jurisdiction. The jurisdiction for the board in this area are the fringes or the outer edges of this canal. It's worth noting that this one's not going to be filled. This one's going to be created into a larger stormwater basin. And we're still moving around the property from east to west. We're now at the southeastern corner. This is the majority of the impact in the board's jurisdiction. It's worth noting this orange line here has been established and denoted as the 2-foot contour, which established the upper limits of the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction. So everything to the south and to the west of this orange line is to be filled with the proposal. That fill is entirely within the board's jurisdiction. What you also have going on, you have some wetlands mitigation areas, another tidal channel to be cut through the existing marsh, and a basin. This area is the high-rise portion of the development right here, and there is a bulkhead proposed with this component. We're moving around, starting to head back towards the north. All you have here is proposed wetlands mitigation, or tidal mitigation. Moving up around towards the north, towards Crab Creek, just wetlands creation. Nothing on this slide. And these are wetlands to be impacted that are not within the board's jurisdiction. Now, this is an existing stormwater basin that is tidally influenced, and the edges are within the board's jurisdiction. The plan is to reconfigure this basin to make it more appropriately used for stormwater control, and those edges of the stormwater basin will be lost. Now we have some cross sections for the proposed piers, a typical cross section for the bulkhead, a typical flood channel section, and oyster shell reef typical section. Now we're going to get into some of the cross sections. I'm going to go through these rather quickly because these, as you can see, there are cross sections labeled A through O throughout the entire property. These are not overlaying specific jurisdictional impacts. These are outlining and overlaying the entire impact of the entire project. So these are not specifically showing just the tidal wetlands impacts for the board. And as you can see, each cross section shows existing elevations, grading that would occur to create more tidal areas. For the most part, these cross sections show an increase with the tidal mitigation areas, how the area will be graded in relation to the existing elevations. I'm going to go through these rather quickly. As you can see, we're moving around from the west to the east here. I will stop at section F to give you an example of jurisdictional impacts. This is Pleasure House Creek over on this side. There are tidal wetlands up to a particular point, and then you have open water behind the existing upland and marsh that facilitates tidal impacts and tidal wetlands up into the property. If you notice this faint gray line, that's the existing elevation currently. This black line is the proposed grade. So what you do have in this instance is tidal wetlands fill along and associated with this open water. So this is an example where the cross-section specifically shows tidal wetlands fill, and that's what's denoted right there, existing tidal wetlands to be filled up to a certain point, which would end the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction. But again, I highlight that these cross-sections are not specifically for the board and their impacts. They're for the entire project. So it's somewhat difficult to go through these and understand the Wetlands Board interactions. I'm going to skip ahead to, and please tell me if you'd like to see one in particular. This is section M. This is highlighting the majority of the fill component of the proposal. This is down at the high-rise development or high-rise component of the development where there would be a bulkhead. They've referenced it here as a retaining wall. These are existing tidal wetlands, and you can see the elevation continues in that manner as tidal wetlands. The board's jurisdiction does stop about a third of the way in here, according to my reading of this drawing. So what you have is a filling of the board's jurisdiction here, along with that impact. So I'm going to go through these and skip right ahead to the ground shots by the city. What these ground shots basically show are three or four things. They show wetlands impact areas, which are within the board's jurisdiction. So you're going to see it's very hard, it seems, for the city to capture exactly what was happening because the project was so large and the area staked off. You may start at the water, but it goes well upland for 100 feet in some cases. So we have wetlands impacts that are jurisdictional, and we have mitigation areas and cross-sectional locations as were shown through A through O. So this is a mitigation area, proposed mitigation area, labeled Area 1. This is section A from the cross section, and you can see how it's staked throughout upland into the property. This is a proposed observation deck at Pleasure House Creek. Cross section B location. Again, section B. Proposed tidal floodways. These are where they would be punching through the existing marsh to allow for tidal interaction for created wetlands. Another tidal floodway. Section D, proposed mitigation area B, and again, any of the mitigation areas, those areas would be altered in some format to allow for wetlands creation. Section E, again, section E, impact areas 1 and 2. When these are labeled impact areas, this means that the board actually has jurisdictional impacts here. Again, 1 and 2, section F from the cross sections. Another tidal floodway, another mitigation area. I think this should actually be mitigation area 3, but I'm not sure if it's labeled incorrectly. Section G from the cross sections, impact area 3. Pipes at G, at cross section G, these pipes are proposed to be removed. Impact area C, mitigation area C. Again, section H from the cross sections, another tidal floodway, impact area 4, again, mitigation area D, mitigation area E, again E, another shot, section J, one last tidal floodway, section K, another mitigation area shot of E, impact area 5, tidal floodway, that structure is proposed to be removed. Impact area 5, section M, section N, O again, and I think we're done. Impact area 6. And that's the last shot that the city showed with their presentation. Along with the slides, the Planning Department recommendation and VIM's evaluation were read into the record. The applicants were represented by their attorney and consultants from Kimley Horn, and about 30 or so citizens spoke in opposition. The Planning Department recommended approval with conditions that included the submittal of monitoring plans and additional tidal elevation data. The VIM's evaluation pointed to several issues that warranted careful consideration, such as the lack of an economic analysis, impacts to avian habitat, the design of tidal floodways, and the impacts of the bulkhead and piers. The applicants presented the development as an improvement to existing site conditions and an opportunity to provide high-quality housing to the area. They maintained the impacts would occur to lower quality and man-made or man-altered wetlands, and for the most part would avoid fringe wetlands along Pleasure House Creek. Impacts to the tidal ditches would allow for much-needed stormwater treatment for the new development and the existing Ocean Park neighborhood adjacent to this parcel. The highlight of the presentation was the creation of approximately 6 acres of higher quality wetlands and the improvement of the stormwater treatment for the area. The applicants also offered to create a conservation easement over all created and remaining tidal wetlands for future protection. This was offered along with an unsubstantiated claim that the applicants owned title to the submerged bottom of Pleasure House Creek through a King's Grant. Now, the applicant had several exhibits on poster board that they showed the wetlands board. I would like to show at least one of them. If the commission wants to go through all 6 or 7, we can, but I think one specifically highlights the impacts, and I'd like to show that at this time.
Why don't you show that one, and if the applicant then wants to show the others that are already in the record, that'll be fine during the course of his presentation.
This is a large plan view drawing. In green, you'll see existing tidal wetlands, or in two shades of green. In the darker green, you'll see the tidal wetlands compensation component. In the purple color, you'll see the actual impacts in the board's jurisdiction. So as you can see, the purple is involved with the three tidal ditches, the city's stormwater pond, and the southeastern point, basically where the fill would occur for the development, for the high-rise portion of the development. And also in purple are highlighted the proposed oyster shell reefs that would be installed over mudflat. If there aren't any questions, I'll go forward.
Continue, please.
The opposition presented their arguments that the proposal did not attempt to avoid the tidal wetlands resource. Protestants complained about the proposed development in general, but some specifically pointed to the Commission's wetlands guidelines and stated that the applicants had not proven why portions of the impacts must occur in tidal wetlands. They also referenced the Commission's wetlands mitigation compensation policy in that the applicants not only failed to justify the necessity of the impacts, but they were attempting to justify the impacts with a large compensation plan. Furthermore, the opposition did not agree that a majority of the proposed impacts would affect lower quality wetlands. They argued that most of the southern side of the property was in fact tidal wetlands before being filled and excavated in the past. Now, to be fair to the opposition, they also had poster boards, and I would show one of their poster boards as well. Now, this essentially shows the same concept and image from the applicant's poster board in that they have taken the large image and highlighted in red the jurisdictional impacts. The only thing different is they left off the impacts around the existing pond, stormwater pond on the north side.
As well as the oyster.
As well as the oyster reef, yes, sir. And I'll leave those up, and, of course, the applicants in opposition have access to them. Or would you like me to take those down right now?
No, they're fine.
Okay. After the presentations, the board questioned David O'Brien from VIMS about the proposal. He acknowledged that the stormwater improvements would be beneficial, but cautioned the board that the proposed wetlands impacts should be evaluated on their own merits, regardless of the compensatory wetlands and stormwater improvements. He also expressed concerns that portions of the project may essentially interrupt the transition of wetlands into the upland buffer, and these buffers are integrally related to the survival of the wetlands. After all of the presentations, each of the 7 board members individually expressed their thoughts and opinions. Members supporting the proposal cited the overall benefits of the stormwater improvements, the sizable quantity of compensatory wetlands, and the rights of the applicants to develop their property, their private property. Members not supporting the proposal questioned whether the applicants had really tried to avoid the existing tidal wetlands. They cited the Commission's wetlands mitigation compensation policy in questioning the water dependency of the project and stated that the proposal did not clearly demonstrate the need to occur in tidal wetlands. They also questioned whether a new development was the appropriate solution to existing stormwater problems and further stated that the city's failure to address these issues in the past does not now justify tidal wetlands impacts. The members not supporting the proposal ultimately questioned the future success of the proposed wetlands and cited the charge of the board as to prevent the destruction and defoliation of tidal wetlands according to the model wetlands ordinance. After the discussion, a motion was made and seconded to approve the proposal with conditions such that the bulkhead component be removed, the future use of nitrogen fertilizer be prohibited, and conservation easements be established over all tidal wetlands and subaqueous bottom. That motion only received 3 affirmative votes, with 4 members voting no. Therefore, in keeping with Chapter 13 of the Code, which specifically requires 4 affirmative votes from a 7-member board, the application was denied. Now, that's a summary of the events. I'm going to go straight into a staff recommendation. I will be reading that verbatim if you'd like to follow along. Section 28.2-1313 of the Code states that the Commission shall modify, remand, or reverse a decision of the board if, in reaching its decision, the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance, or the substantial rights of the appellant or the applicant have been prejudiced because the findings, conclusions, or decisions are A, in violation of constitutional provisions, B, in excess of statutory authority or jurisdiction, C, made upon unlawful procedure, D, affected by other error of law, E, unsupported by the evidence on the record considered as a whole, or F, arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. Under Section 4, Criteria for Alterations of Wetlands, of the Wetlands Guidelines promulgated by this Commission, the following alterations of the shoreline are ordinarily not justified. For purposes or activities which can be conducted on existing fast lands and which have no inherent requirement for access to water resources, and when there are viable alternatives which can achieve the given purpose without adversely affecting marshes. Furthermore, the guidelines stress that high-density development in or immediately adjacent to wetlands is discouraged. As such, the board's decision to deny the proposal based on the undocumented need for the project elements to be located in tidal wetlands appears consistent with the guidelines. The board clearly stated that the applicants had not provided adequate justification for the actual impacts to occur in the tidal wetlands resource, nor was avoidance and minimization fully utilized as clearly stated in the guidelines. While staff acknowledges that the creation of approximately 6 acres of tidal wetlands will undoubtedly benefit the property, as well as provide additional stormwater treatment, that is not the core issue of this proposal and the board's decision. At issue is the necessity and justification of all tidal wetland impacts, and the board clearly stated that they did not feel the applicants provided that. Similarly, the Commission's wetlands mitigation compensation policy requires that all proposals must stand on their own merits and that compensation should not be used to justify permit issuance. The policy goes on to state that alternate siting must be included in mitigation. The proposal must clearly be water dependent and must clearly demonstrate the need to be in wetlands and its overwhelming public and private benefits. The dissenting board members raised these very issues throughout the hearing, questioning whether the proposal to create approximately 6 acres of tidal wetlands and to substantially treat stormwater passing over the property should be used to justify the initial project impacts. In the end, a majority of the board appropriately did not use the proffer of wetlands creation and stormwater improvements to justify the proposed losses. In spite of the appellant's allegations, and based on our review of the record, staff cannot conclude that the board failed to fulfill its responsibilities or that the substantial rights of the applicant were prejudiced by a procedural error by the board in hearing this matter. Accordingly, staff believes that this decision is well within the powers granted the locality by Chapter 13 of Section 28.2 of the Code and recommends that the May 21st decision of the Virginia Beach Wetlands Board be upheld. Should the applicants decide to reapply in a modified form, staff recommends they do so only after having received both local zoning and Chesapeake Bay Board approval, since decisions in these areas or by the appropriate boards may either further justify or decrease the amount of tidal wetlands impacts necessary. So we made it through that.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm available for any questions.
Good questions from members of the commission. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation, Justin. I have a couple of questions. First, I would ask, in your analysis, do you think the board was justified in considering buffer impacts related to the application in its decision to deny the application? I look at some of the concluding remarks in the record. For example, at page 102, Dr. Benson cites these buffer concerns. He says, I have obviously concerns about the buffers and the viability of the wetlands. I think I'm appropriate in considering that. Do you think that's an appropriate consideration for that board in making
this
decision?
Having been there and read through the transcript and working with David O'Brien, VIMS is essentially brought up the issue about the buffers and concerns that the applicant stated during the hearing that the buffers were not necessary for wetlands existence or survival. So I think a lot of that was taken from that conversation, that line of questioning, that explanation, and Mr. O'Brien stated that he took issue with that point and that wetlands needed to survive and have a functioning buffer for their existence. So without speaking for the board, I didn't feel that it was inappropriate that the board members tied the natural contiguity of the buffer in the wetlands.
Okay, and a second question, if I may. Based on the record, there appears to me to be a fairly strong basis that the applicant, or argument that the applicant makes for justifying some of their impacts to the wetlands related to the stormwater improvements. And I realize that I think in your assessment you said that caution was offered that stormwater improvements alone shouldn't justify all of the impacts. But having said that, it seems that some of those impacts are have a record basis for being justified. Are there which impacts on this site do you think are not justified based on the application?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that specifically because I'm not sure with the applicant's proposal for development which areas are more essential than others. Obviously, if we look at this slide, it looks like there's a higher density of development here on the southeastern corner. But your stormwater issues specifically addressed are with the pond and the tidal ditches here. The way we looked at it and the way I felt the board looked at it, or at least the majority of the board, is that there are obviously stormwater problems with the site. And treating the stormwater wasn't necessarily the purpose of the project. Whether the development was the purpose and treating the stormwater was the benefit, I don't know that I can answer for the applicants as to what was their primary goal. But it's obvious, based on the testimony, that they did not feel they could develop to this point, to this amount, without addressing stormwater in this manner. Now, how much could be reduced to allow for the existing tidal wetlands not to be impacted, I can't answer that. But it's obvious that they felt that stormwater needed to be handled or treated in a certain manner to garner further approval, whether it be through Chesapeake Bay Board, DCR, DEQ, I'm not sure. I can't answer that. And that wasn't specifically addressed or covered in depth with the board. However, I guess to summarize, I still look at that as staff. I still look at that as compensation. It wasn't the intended purpose, and the board members that voted against this stated as such.
Thank you.
And part of that, I guess, to go on record, is my opinion as staff. I can't speak for the board members in trying to summarize how they got to this point, or the applicants in terms of why certain amount of stormwater can be treated and certain portions can't, involving tidal wetlands.
Understood. Any further questions? Yep, counsel.
You'd mentioned that several of these, I think the areas in orange are beyond the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction. Is that because of the delineation of the geographic extent of the tidal area?
Let me go back to a slide that shows us a little bit better. I don't know if that's any better. Now, you referencing these orange areas, this orange area here?
Well, whichever areas you identified are beyond the Wetlands Board.
Well, this is somewhat difficult, and I'll try to explain as best I can. Given the history of this property, you have existing wetlands on the fringe of Pleasure House Creek, on the outside edge, obviously within the board's jurisdiction. Over time, throughout the dredging and the excavating and the dewatering of these sites, of this site, tidal ditches and culverts and pipes were placed here. It's my understanding that initially this was not intended to be tidal, but it has become tidal over time for whatever reason and whoever's fault. I don't think we can get into that, nor did the record get into that specifically. But for whatever reason, it is now tidal and it's within the board's jurisdiction. So what you have is no longer a specific jurisdictional boundary on the outside along Pleasure House Creek, but you then have areas, depending on the elevation of the pipes or depending on the areas or the canals, the elevation of the canals, you have certain areas that are jurisdictional and certain ones that are not. And they are still tied into the 1.5 mean tidal elevations. So it is somewhat complicated to follow. This was covered with Virginia Beach staff, with Mr. O'Brien from VIMS, and I think it was addressed somewhat at the board, but you have what they've established is a 2-foot contour in some areas that is the upper limits of the Wetlands Board jurisdiction. So it's not unusual in this site to have tidal wetlands impacts that are not jurisdictional for the City of Virginia Beach, but maybe jurisdictional for DEQ or the Corps.
Mr. Schick?
Did the record show that the applicant had discussed the interior wetlands and how they were affected by man-made applications prior to 1971?
Yes, sir. They detailed it somewhat. I'm not an authority on this site and the matter. I'm sure Bob Grab or Randy Owen could give you more history, but they did cover that somewhat. And for what it's worth, it is in the record. Yes, sir.
Further questions? Thank you, Justin.
Okay.
The applicant, present and represented, Mr. Daniel, Mr. Nutter.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, sir.
Commissioner. Members of the Commission, for the record, my name is R.J. Nutter. I'm an attorney. I'm representing the applicant today, the appellant today, and I'd also like to bring to your attention a large group of people who have worked with me on this. Quite frankly, I'm just the lucky or unlucky spokesman, if you put it, and I'm not sure how you want to view that. But with me today is John Daniel and John Byram with my Richmond office. In addition to that, we have a large contingent from Kinley Horn, the engineers on this site. Very technical questions you all gentlemen may have. We fully have the capability to answer any of those questions you might have. And I want to thank them for all their assistance and help in this process. Members of the Commission, if I could, I'd like to begin a little bit by telling you what I'd like to discuss with you, and then so that I can you at least know where I'm headed here. First of all, I'd like to go over why I believe there's some review of the statutory law is going to be applicable here that affects wetlands in the state, because I think part of what our argument of why the board erred is, frankly, is that both the misapplication of those statutes and, frankly, the pure going around those statutes, presenting new standards that don't exist in the regulations and, more importantly, in the statutes today. Secondly, I'm going to go over very briefly the staff analysis by the local staff in a little bit more detail, and primarily because the local staff in this case, the staff of both the City of Virginia Beach Wetland Board and Chesapeake Bay Board, evaluated this application and had an opportunity that your staff did not have, quite frankly. They worked on this application for over 6 months. They worked in the field on repeated visits with both the opposition, our client, our engineers, and representatives from VIMS and others. So I can share that with you because they have an extraordinary amount of knowledge and expertise they brought to their recommendation. So when your staff indicates that the local staff recommended approval, I will tell you it should not be taken lightly, and I'll go over the reasons why shortly. Then I'd like to go into just a brief overview of the application because this is a very unique application. And why I believe that the guidelines, frankly, we do meet the standard for this set forth in your guidelines, and why we'll show you why we believe the board erred as a matter of law, why they applied the wrong standards, why they misapplied the standards, and why, quite frankly, they applied an inappropriate procedure, unlike what took place here earlier today when Mr. McCluskey left the room. So I'd like to go over those features with you, and I'll conclude by telling you what I believe are the chilling effects of this decision, why I believe it could have a detrimental effect on stormwater retrenchment and stormwater improvement programs around the Commonwealth of Virginia, in particular in Tampton Roads and Tidewater. And I'll cite a specific example of why I believe that's the problem. But first, let me begin, as I indicated to you, by telling you a little bit about the history of the wetlands. And I'm not going to try to lecture you all because you deal with this every day. But I do think it's important to understand that the premise of what the local wetland board did was impose a strict standard when, in fact, the standards set forth in the guidelines and the standards set forth in the statutes are, in fact, a meshing of the components that lead to our wetland policy today in Virginia. In fact, your guidelines go on to state that multiple interests are to be weighed in the development of guidelines and the development of laws respecting wetlands: the public's interests, economic and general welfare of the Commonwealth, the protection of private property rights, wildlife and marine fisheries. And they point out that the goal is to prevent the disfoliation of, and destruction of wetlands, and most importantly, and this keeps getting left out, most importantly, and to accommodate necessary economic development in a manner that preserves wetlands. That's very important because, quite frankly, your staff, as well as the chairman of the board and the chairman of the local board, never failed to mention the second part of that formula. That'd be like saying, Mr. Commissioner, all the commissioners on this side, don't worry about it. You're not relevant in this case. All the commissioners on this side, you are relevant. Both parties are relevant. The standard is for both policies to apply. In fact, this is not a litmus test of you may not touch a wetland in this Commonwealth, period. That is what your laws, the statutes say. That's why the General Assembly adopted 28.2.1301. And specifically, they directed this commission not just to deal with these conflicting interests, but to develop a process to evaluate the functional values of vegetated and non-vegetated wetlands. Because they realized that, quite frankly, you must manage this important resource. Wetlands are not protected because of what they are. They are protected because of what they do. And that's why you go through elaborate detail in your regulations and guidelines to garner these in different levels of importance. And you have level and category one wetlands are very preserved more than the others. But while all are important, if there's a reference that you have to disturb them, you disturb the ones that are least significant and provide the least functional value. So, in fact, you then go on in your guidelines as to the state statute, and it says what are the criteria under which you evaluate a wetland's impact. And you evaluate them based on their value. And their value is based on four functions set out in your guidelines at page 6. If you look for the marine habitat effect of these features, you look for the erosion buffer that they provide, you look for the water quality control that they provide, and you look for the flood buffer and flood protection that they provide. I can tell you in this case, the status quo of this property, in fact, if I may ask Justin's assistance in putting up one of the photographs, if I could just, how did you do it on here, Justin? Forgive me.
Well, actually, John, is these right here if you want to use these.
They're fine. Well, actually, I'll turn to those in a second, but this will be fine, okay. Just using this one. I can tell you that the status quo of this property, actually, where the wetlands that we'll be impacting, preserve actually do not serve any, let me underestimate, any of those four primary functions that are identified in both the statute and identified in your guidelines. They do none. And when, in fact, the application in this case is proposing to modify wetlands, and I want to reiterate that. We're not eliminating wetlands on this site. When this is over with, there will be 4.5 acres more wetlands than exist today. There will be 6.09 new acres of wetlands, and all of those will be Category 1 or Level 1 wetlands, not Level 4 and 5 category wetlands, which are being disturbed today. So my point to you is that the wetlands we're affecting will be exactly in line with your guidelines, exactly in line with the state statute that was set forth. There is not a thou shalt not touch any wetland in the state process, and that's one of the reasons why the local board erred in its evaluation of this application. Now, the second thing I'd like to point out about this analysis is that when we looked at how to manage the ecology of the site, I want to talk about that for a second. And I say that because, as you all probably know, 28.2.1301 of the state statute gives you, the commission, the power, once you have wetlands under your prerogative, to manage those so that, quite frankly, and this is an interesting point, to maximize their ecological value. You want to maintain the highest standard and highest functionality of those wetlands that you can. And you may have to manage that site to get to those features. Now, and so as a result of that, I point out to you that in the process of doing that, that's exactly what we have done. We're dealt the situation with the unique facts in this property. And I want to point out a couple to you, first of all, but one of them I'd like to go very quickly to is the question raised about, I think it was Mr. Schick, I beg your pardon, I hope it was you, but I believe you asked the question of why we had to address the stormwater of this property. And the point that Mr. Worrell didn't point out to is that local ordinances require that if stormwater runs through our site and we are going to develop our property, we have to deal with that stormwater. We are required by state law, required by local ordinance to deal with this. It's not like we're being benevolent. We think it's the right thing to do. In this case, the city makes out like a bandit because it's done by the private sector, not by the public sector. But the reality is we're required by law to deal with that. So we have that obligation in proceeding. It's not a stated purpose in the process. It is a requirement of law that we deal with it. The second thing I'd like to point out to you about the unique nature of the site, and your staff did not go into great detail about this, is that this is a unique piece of property, highly manipulated as a result of years of study by the Army Corps of Engineers and years ago Princess Anne County. And this is all in your record, by the way. This was a study, the site was studied for a dredge disposal site in the Lynn Haven River by then Princess Anne County, the Army Corps of Engineers, in the 1950s and 1960s. It was eventually selected in the late 1960s, 1970, and as a result of that, it became, and I'll show you, just because it's easier for me, I'm a little bit more challenged with these pictures, gentlemen. But if I could show you these aerial photographs that we submitted to staff, they're important to show the unique nature of this, but also to show you that this is, quite frankly, a highly manipulated site. And under your regulations, under state statute, one of the areas which we're asked to look if we have to impact wetlands is to impact wetlands that are lower category in functional value and, more importantly, have been irreversibly disturbed prior to July 1972. These photographs were taken to show that this area was once a natural marsh. It was selected as a site by the Corps, and what they did is they filled the entire site. In fact, the larger area than the site was filled as well. Portions of the Ocean Park neighborhood have been filled with the sand that was a result of these dredging projects. When they did that, they construct a berm around the perimeter of the property. I'll put this up here for just a second.
Mr. Nutter, real quickly, can you tell me what the approximate date is on the lower left photograph?
It says in early 1972.
Okay, thank you.
And by the way, I want to point out that the derogation of the property here is uncontested. Most of the facts in this case, quite frankly, are uncontested, I can point out to you. So no one's contesting the fact that he was irreversibly disturbed prior to 1972 with photographs and so forth. Your staff points it out, our staff points it out in their recommendation. So to do that, they build a berm around the perimeter of the property, and I'm going to use Justin's pen here. I can figure it out.
this works.
Well, along the perimeter of the... Justin?
Thank you. You had it there. Yeah. There you go.
Thank you very much. You sure I do now?
You might want to use the...
Okay, thank you. Forgive me, Jeff. No, you're fine. It's all right. The perimeter of the property, they built a berm system around the perimeter of the property. And they pumped the sand, as you probably are familiar, up on the property, just as these photographs to my right have indicated. When they did that, they then constructed these three ditches that are right here. Those three ditches, sole purpose at the time of their construction, was to dewater the sand from the site so that the sand could be then excavated subsequently and put on beaches around the City of Virginia Beach, on Chesapeake Beach, as well as on the City of Virginia Beach at the oceanfront. So these were never intended to serve as tidal features. In fact, the directed is in the record. On seven different times, the Army Corps of Engineers has directed to the property owners and to their contractors, do not let these features become tidal. They are solely to dewater the site from the property, the water coming on this site from the sand they put on the dredging material. Never intended to be tidal at all. In addition to that, not only that, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the city approached the then property owner and said, we want to use that for drainage. We don't have a stormwater system at all for the whole Ocean Park area, so we must flow the water into those drainage ditches if you like it. And then that property owner granted them a temporary easement for drainage into those ditches. So when we talk about these ditches being right here, the water you saw on those ditches does not come from the tidal activity of the river or the creek. The water you saw in the ditches comes from the massive amounts of stormwater for this area, and I'll go into that in a second, that are pumped underground under Marlin Bay Drive. This is Marlin Bay Drive, and large culverts into those ditches. The water from this site runs from those neighborhoods down out to the river. That's why you have some opportunistic tidal wetlands along the perimeter of this. But my point to you is that part of the reason we're going to show you that why the board erred below is because they kept focusing on whether that was water-dependent. Water-dependent relies to a shoreline activity mover. They were proposing that those internal perimeters of the ditches were shoreline. Well, that may be a technically, I can't even think if it's technically correct, because the only connection of those features to the water is through the pipes that staff just pointed out to you. So if you think you can maneuver, navigate any of those and treat that like a shoreline, that is why they misapplied the regulation and said, therefore, there must be a water-dependent nature for that. That's the basis of water dependency in this entirely. Other than those, gentlemen, all the other activity that's on the perimeter remains intact, as those, Justin did a great job of showing these sectional pieces. And as you saw, there's nothing being proposed in these areas except for two things. Number one, we propose an oyster restoration program along through here, which it seems odd to me. I don't do a lot of this type of work, ladies and gentlemen, but it seems odd to me that when we put oysters down on the bottom of the river to try to restore oysters in that area and clean the ground, clean the water, that actually has a wetland impact that we have to mitigate for. But nonetheless, we're doing that. So the only features, again, are those oyster reefs and the cuts that we have to make in this area so that the wetlands we're creating behind it are properly watered and there's sufficient nutrient flow up into those areas. In fact, we were asked to make those cuts to standards set by VIMS, and we agreed to do that. That's fine. So the only activity on the perimeter or real shoreline of this property that is a water-dependent activity is, frankly, those features at all. That's the only features we're being impacted. That's what we say. They really misapplied that process entirely to that regulation. Now, let me go over as a continue along as the process of the application, because I want to point out to you that why we believe this complies with the standards set forth in your ordinance. We have one of the most important parts of this is that you avoid your wetlands, the perimeter wetlands in particular, and the high-quality valued wetlands. It's interesting to me that 86% of the wetlands on this site are completely avoided. 86%. Only 14% of the wetlands on this site are impacted. I'd like to go to this.
Might want to
Yeah, okay. I guess you don't have a portable mic. But this is an exhibit we prepared and submitted in the record. All of the wetlands, the 1.51 acres of wetlands, let me show you exactly where they are, if I could. There are features around these three ditches right here. The city pond right here, and I'll tell you about that in a second. And this area up in here, and I'll tell you about that in a separate process as well. And then finally, the oyster restoration program. This is 0.24 acres of the 1.51, which brings us down to 1.27 acres of impact, the rest of this, consisting of the area around these ditches, the ponds, which are there solely 100% to deal with stormwater treatment. The other area, right here, is tidal only because the pipes that were put in here to prevent it from becoming tidal in the first place by the prior owner have sunk down into the mud. And therefore, there's some tidal influence that's occurring there. So they're technically tidal. They don't function tidal, and that's why you have in this area, over 80% of the wetlands in this area are phragmites. We have programs in this state to actually discourage that. Oh, thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, guys. Let's see this. Ah, there we go. I think I've got something that works. So if I could, then I can stay at this mic. So these are the features that we're impacting solely because of stormwater. And let me tell you why we have no choice but to deal with that issue. First, we're required by the state law and local ordinance to deal with water coming through our site. Second, as you see, the city would have to actually condemn properties outside our property if they were going to deal with it by building stormwater ponds. What we have proposed instead is that we would close two of these features. And by the way, the wetlands along these features have no tidal influence. They have a measurable tidal influence, but no significant tidal influence. They provide no habitat, no flood control. In fact, what they really do is they present the possibility of flooding coming up into the property in large tidal events or significant storms. So they present a danger to the property. And in addition to that, a large amount of contaminated water is coming through those ditches today, injuring my client's property, which he has a right, in my opinion, to start to deal with. It's coming through his property. He needs to deal with it. The pond, the city pond, which was built by the city, interesting enough, was built prior to the time the regulations that were in effect today that set forth the standard. God bless you. That's the standard for construction of those features. And to make it worse, the weir that the city installed here that takes this water out of these features, supposed to take the stormwater and high stormwater events for the outfall, has failed. The city failed to maintain it. Thus, this now has tidal activity in it. That's why you have this tidal activity up around that feature. What we're proposing to do is, quite frankly, build a new stormwater feature here and close off the weir so the new will be built to city standards. This pond would be expanded to treat the stormwater. These two would be closed. And all the stormwater from the area around it, which is larger than the size of this project, that's what this exhibit, I can keep reporting this one. I'll show you right here. This is the area that drains through this property today. This is what you may have heard about in the newspaper, reported on this. This is the 92 millions of gallons of water a year that flow unchecked just through these four features out into the river, into the creek. 92 million, that's 100 pounds of phosphorus and 1,000 pounds of fertilizer every year going into that system, going into these systems. That's what boggles my mind, the opposition is trying to preserve in this process. That's why we believe we've offered the only real answer for cleaning up stormwater, protecting, adding additional wetlands, and all the features set forth in your statute. But this is a very important exhibit that our staff looked at very heavily, and of course, you know, three of the members of the board took this into great consideration. Down. The other component of this project is down in here. And that project, that portion of the property, is not impacted as a result of the tidal activity, the flooding activity, or the stormwater process that we have to carry out for the rest of it. That portion of the property, those wetlands, however, are over 80% phragmites. Those portions are actually deterring the development of the wetlands around them. That's why we went into those areas, to get clean those areas up and add new wetlands around them.
that's what this application was doing. Now, in the mitigation process, by the way, isn't that to justify this? It's to manage the wetlands on this site. Just like you must do if you have a site that has significant environmental features on it, how do you manage it? And what you do is you take the lower quality wetlands around the perimeter areas that are serving no purpose to the property, they have no functional value whatsoever, and to add insult to injury, they're allowing millions of gallons, almost hundreds of millions of gallons a year, water, untreated water, into these features. Those have to be, we would think, cleaned up, taken care of. What you do is you put your best wetlands, your class one wetlands, out along the perimeter. What this exhibit shows, as Justin told you, the light green color is the existing perimeter wetland system today. You see no impact of that. The dark green is where the wetlands will be adding to them. So when this is done, you will have a wider, broader, fully functional, fully habitat protected, fully irrigated from natural waters and a real tidal system, providing flood control, erosion control, buffer control, habitat, and natural, real full tidal interchange around the perimeter of this property that doesn't exist today. That is why, if you look at the standards set forth in the application in your statute, we believe we met those criteria. And I'm going to now go to why, quite frankly, we believe the board erred. Now, we raise in our brief, which we submitted to you, several issues that I would like to go over with you.
Just to caution you, just make sure that what you're going over was contained in the record as well and
yes,
not additional.
Okay, sir, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Nutter.
The first issue we raised, quite frankly, Mr. Commissioner, was the fact that the board acted pursuant to an unlawful procedure. We had a member of our board, and by the way, this doesn't mean anything about him. He's a wonderful gentleman. Don't take this in the wrong context. We had a member of the board that was an active member of the opposition group involved. He had solicited city council's input to oppose this project. He had solicited a plan to council, and all this is pursuant to the record, everything in the record that you have. Solicited council program that would provide for raising of both public funds, grants, and private monies to try to acquire this property. And he had taken that proposal not once but twice to the two city council representatives who represent this area. During the time he was acting on this application. And we raised that question to the chairman and asked him to please consider asking this gentleman to recuse himself. We're not asking him to step back from the board. We're asking him merely to recuse himself because we believed, quite frankly, that may have been a conflict of interest. Number one, it certainly spoke how it impacted the integrity of the board's decision. And frankly, it impinged my client's right to a fair hearing. So, unfortunately, the gentleman chose not to do so, and that's particularly bad in this situation for two reasons. Number one, the local statute, as you know, requires the affirmative vote of the majority of the members appointed, regardless of the number that are there, and regardless of members who vote who might be able to disqualify. That's why we have three alternates on the board. So alternates were available for this very purpose. And yet that refused to take place. And this is based on my letter of May 21st, 2007 to the board that I referred to in your record. Now, the error occurred, in my opinion, not only that he participated, but the error that is, I'm afraid, completely reversible is the fact that the statute provides that if you're a member of an official membership in a group whose interests are implicated by the outcome of the matter, where an official is a member of a group having such an interest in a transaction before him, the official may participate in the transaction only after disclosing his membership in the group and declaring that he is nonetheless able to act fairly, objectively, in the public interest, Mr. Chairman, just like you read in the record at the beginning of your hearing. As you know, this did not occur in this case.
The record is devoid of any indication that he disclosed that or made that disclosure or that announcement that he felt like he could proceed fairly and objectively. Unlike what your staff has told you, this is not a minor error. This is a direct conflict of the Act, and the requirements of that Act are mandatory. And they provide him with being able to participate solely if he complies with that. So his participation and vote, therefore, are in violation of that Act, if for no other reason than he failed to disclose it and say he could act prudently. One. Now, again, Mr. Barron, Mr. Hyten, and Mr. Barron, somewhat, and I'll tell you, he's a wonderful gentleman. And I don't know if he knows what he got himself into with all of this, quite frankly. But by the same token, he should have recused himself or disclosed his interest on the record, which he failed to do. The second reason why the board, this matter should be reversed is that the board exceeded its jurisdiction by not complying with the standards set forth in 28.2.1302 for approval of an application. That statute sets forth three criteria, which I'm going to go over a little bit in detail with you, that we believe are all present on the record in this case. Number one, the anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed project exceeds the public and private detriment. Now, the public and private approval here, benefits, are rather overwhelming. We're treating 92 million gallons of water. Oof, thank you very much. 92 million gallons of water. We're treating that water, by the way, to almost 80% in excess of state standards, by the way, not just the amount, but the quality of the treatment. We have a 24-acre restoration park. We have a conservation easement over 46 acres of bottomland that could be dredged by right because of the King's Grant, in addition to two osprey nets, osprey features on here. So, and we're eliminating over almost 1 acre of Phragmites of the 1.5 acres that we're proposing to impact. Now, under your guidelines, it's very clear that that is a primary criteria. We met that very clearly. Second, it conforms with the standards set forth in 28.1302, which sets forth that you look, you try to avoid the high-quality wetlands of what we did, and you then go to where you must focus your wetland impacts on areas that were prior disturbed prior to 1972, which we've shown in the photographs we did. Finally, you must comply with the guidelines and the intent of the ordinance, and the intent of the statute is, quite frankly, not only to preserve wetlands, as we said, if 10 of this application, there will be 6 new acres of wetlands available into this watershed that don't exist today. And they're all high quality in the same watershed. And it promotes economic development and promotes the city stormwater ordinance in the process. So we believe we met all those standards. But nonetheless, the board in this case selected a new standard which says, quite frankly, that they don't want to have any impacts on wetlands on the property. In fact, the chairman stated, it's been quoted more than anything I've ever seen, we don't destroy wetlands in the nature of water quality. This turns state law on its head. As I've told you before, it's a balancing process. It's a series of things that your guidelines set forth, the state standards set forth. If you didn't qualify them and quantify them, you wouldn't need to do that. This is solely the wrong standard, quite frankly. It is dead wrong against the statute. As I told you earlier, it also misapplied the application of the shoreline requirement for making that a water-dependent activity on these features up here. I guess it's okay to build a marina up here, but it's not okay to clean up 92 million gallons of stormwater. That was the error in that analysis. Finally, and most importantly, as you look at the evidence as a whole, the board's decision is unsupported by evidence on the record and is arbitrary and capricious. That's not a standard, frankly, that I take lightly. It's very rare when you try to hold to that standard, but it honestly applies in this case for two reasons. One, we met all the criteria in the ordinance. Two, the evidence that was presented against this application, again, with staff's recommendation and VIM's very glowing report on this application. With both those features, the opposition presented a series of arguments that either involved items not before their jurisdiction, within jurisdiction, items on the Chesapeake Bay Board, items on the for the DEQ, avian impacts, or, quite frankly, they referred to old applications that didn't even have application in some cases to this property, or where they did refer to old staff comments. Here's what happened. I'm sorry, Mr. Tankard. What happened is
the prior prior owner of this property had applied to the Corps for a permit. Many agencies commented on that and had many dilatory comments. As a result of that, the Army Corps went through a full Section 7 review to hear those comments and make a decision. The Army Corps of Engineers decided to issue a permit on this site.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
So as a result of that, ladies and gentlemen, the basis of the arguments against us were a collection of old arguments that applied some to this case, some to not. And all the record evidence taken as a whole supports the approval of this application based upon the standards set forth in your statute.
Thank you, sir. Any questions of Mr. Nutter from members of the commission? Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to briefly explore the conflict of interest claim that the applicant's counsel has raised. Before I proceed with that line of questioning, though, I would like to say a couple of things. I'm not questioning the integrity of the Wetlands Board in any way or the individual in question. On the contrary, citizen boards play a very essential role in the administration of state and local government, serving sacrificially and working hard. But the applicant's claim, I think, does raise questions about the fairness of the Wetland Board's proceeding and warrants some consideration. And I would ask, based on the evidence in the record, how do you believe that this issue resulted in the applicant being denied a fair hearing?
I believe that in several ways. We would have been entitled, quite frankly, to the appointment of an adjunct member who could have sat and heard this, in my opinion, very fairly and without a direct prejudice. You have to remember, this member had a direct, potentially direct pecuniary effect on what the outcome of this decision would have been. Because if he was raising money to try to get counsel to buy this property and he somehow can get this property denied in Wetlands, perhaps this was less valuable. So our belief, thank you, Mr. Robbins, it would have been that they should have appointed an adjunct member to sit in his place and not have that prejudice onto the other members, because there's a very good, clear interaction amongst the members of this commission.
Thank you. And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, it seems that I guess one thing in the code that I'm wrestling with, under 28.2-1303, there is a provision for the chairman of the Wetland Board to replace a member who's not going to be at the hearing, who notifies the chairman 24 hours or more in advance of such a meeting that he's not going to be there, with an alternate. However, I mean, I don't know of any legal authority whereby the chairman can replace a recused member. So, how do you legally get past that such that the outcome could have been changed? In other words, if he couldn't have been replaced.
Right.
Hypothetically, had he could not been replaced, I have a hard time seeing how the outcome would have been changed.
I understand. The chairman, don't get me wrong, I don't think this obligation falls on the chairman, number one. I think this obligation falls on the member. And what the statute provides is that, regardless of whether or not he should have sat, what he was required to do under the law is exactly what you all did at the beginning of this hearing and what Mr. McCluskey did. He made a determination, but he had to disclose that on the record up front, and that was not done. Now, that's just a matter of law. You can't do that. That's why I think when that happens, number one, that's a vote that could have changed the outcome of this hearing, could have forced perhaps a rehearing. It could have resulted in another member being the problem with that, when he doesn't disclose it, then we're left to go into the process of filing an appeal. So, and that's, no one wants to, frankly, appeal those decisions. But I can tell you my client is entitled to a fair hearing by a fair and impartial board of people who come and look at the evidence objectively, and not by people who have made a predetermination and have been part of a group that's intent on stopping all development of this property and raising money to buy it for other purposes.
Mr. Tankard?
Mr. Nutter, you mentioned 28.2-1302, public and private benefit, and two of the things you mentioned there,
yes,
economic activity, and then the other was conservation easement. Conservation easement first. Who's going to hold that easement, and what will you be easing in particular?
Yes, sir. I'll be happy to tell you. This property consists of about 100 and somewhere between 114 and 116 acres, depending upon which survey you want to follow, sir. And it runs out here. The upland area is about 69 acres. We have a King's grant that we are submitting to the state and to the agencies to prove that, in fact, that's a process that takes some time. But that the easement we were proposing would run over that entire bottom land area and over the newly created wetland areas, the mitigation areas that we're creating in here on the green. That would have been granted, and we're looking at several sources. We were looking at possible local Chesapeake Bay Foundation. We were looking at the state. There's a process in the state statute you can dedicate that to. We had not made a determination, but we had made it a condition of what we were applying for that we would, in fact, grant that conservation easement. And Ms. Pankard, you may know this, but that a King's Grant is that's a significant opportunity because that reverses 400 years of absolute right to go in and dredge and fill this area without VMRC approval. So that's a significant change in facts that will benefit this property and this watershed. So in fact, in some ways it's more significant than frankly anything else we're doing on the property, in my thinking, quite frankly. But it's a significant fact.
Further questions?
The second part of my question was the economic activity part that you mentioned in general. Do you have any thoughts on numbers, et cetera, that will benefit Hampton Roads, Virginia Beach?
This project, I'd like to address that question, and I'd like to talk. I'll have to admit something to you. I'm going to try to address something I didn't address
Mr. Worrell?
Excuse me. I think we need to be careful that this may raise new information that may not have been covered at the wetlands hearing.
Okay.
And we can ask Mr. Nutter, is he going to cover anything? Because I don't know that this was specifically addressed at the hearing.
Thank you for bringing that up. Is it Mr. Nutter? Because we've not voted to open the record.
I understand.
And I want to make sure this record is perfected.
I understand. I can't tell you that we got into actual economic data within the record. It's probably elsewhere in the process at the city. In our rezoning applications and others. If I could comment on one thing, though, that I've been asked why we are here and why we. And one of the conditions of your staff recommendation is if for whatever reason we lose today, we have to come back, we go through the rezoning process first. I want to comment just very briefly on that. The only reason we are here in not after the rezoning process is because Virginia Beach has a policy that they will not allow an applicant who has Chesapeake Bay or wetlands impacts to proceed with their application to planning commissions until after they've completed that environmental process. So that's why you may have wondered, I don't know, but I just want to let you know that's why, number one, we couldn't comply with that staff criteria if that was adopted. But the reason why we're here today, quite frankly, is not of our own choosing. We follow the policy dictated to us by the city.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nutter. Mr. Schick?
Yes, concerning the wetlands that are on the, I guess it's the eastern part.
Yes, sir. In that portion?
Yeah, that portion there. Yes, now, if you could kind of go through the steps of, were these wetlands created?
Happy to answer that.
You know, in a sense of because of the dredging project and the reason why these Phragmites are grown there is because it is a dysfunctional area.
I'm happy to answer that question. In fact, the sole reason this is here is because when the prior property owner entered into an agreement with the city of Virginia Beach, in this case, city had an immediate need for sand, and another dredge spoil site just down the river had not lived up to his obligation. And the city came to the then owner of this property and said, we want to remove sand from your site. And they were in that provision, they were required to level that area so there would be no indentations and no depressed areas. They did not do that. As a result of that, this area became a depressed area and water started to form. And then when these pipes failed in here, that became influenced by tidal activities. That's why it's landward of the berm system. It's outside the perimeter, landward of the perimeter berms and the wetlands. And that's why you have such poor tidal interchange, and that's why the Phragmites have flourished in that area.
So not only is it a...
Mr. Schick.
So you're saying not only was it first filled, then it was dug out, and this was all government-sponsored
yes,
activity.
Sir. Yes, sir. In the record before this commission, I can tell you that there was a prior wetland board application. And in that application, the then owner of the property, who has since recused himself today, made it very clear that not one inch of sand has been put on this property or removed from this property by anyone other than the federal, local, or state government.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Nutter. You'll be afforded 10 to 15 minutes to rebut summary at the end of the
Thank you, Mr.
hearing. Ms. Wilson? Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
You'll be afforded 35 minutes if you need it, because it did go over a little bit. Some of it was questioning and some of it was elaboration of the question. So, in a matter of fairness, I think that's appropriate.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Josephson. My name is Kay Wilson. I'm an Associate City Attorney with the City of Virginia Beach, and I represent the Wetlands Board here today. We didn't bring our large contingency. It's simply me and Wayne Couch, who is staff, to the Wetlands Board. This is an appeal by the applicant, Indigo Dunes, to the May 21st, 2007 decision of the Wetlands Board of the City of Virginia Beach. On May 21st, the motion of the board was to approve the application with conditions, specifically four, but it failed by a 3-4 vote, and the project was denied. It was an exhausting meeting with stacks of evidence, as you have in front of you, and approximately 27 speakers in opposition to the project, as well as those who spoke on behalf of the applicant. However, before I get into that, there are a couple of issues that I must start with in my presentation to you, issues that are not something that I usually deal with when I come before this commission. First is the issue of the memorandum that was sent to you in your agenda packages from the applicant. This is not the usual practice for the VMRC staff, and as my letter that you all got opposing this practice explains, the board has two concerns with this. The inclusion of the memorandum in the agenda package of the commission unfairly prejudices the commissioners in favor of the arguments of the applicants, as they were allowed an ex parte communication with the commission without the board or the citizens being granted the same opportunity. This forum today should be a level playing field, and with the inclusion of this memorandum and the exclusion of the board, it is not. Such an inclusion is tantamount to an ex parte conversation, and while they're not specifically prohibited by the Administrative Process Act, their use in such a flagrant manner illuminates the spirit of due process and procedural rights. Surely the board and the citizens have a right to expect an unbiased decision maker without the troubling specter of impropriety. The commission should make every effort to ensure that the proceedings of this body are not tainted by this problem, and now it's impossible to do so.
Ms. Wilson, for the record, you can continue, and your objection is so noted. In checking with legal counsel pertaining to this memorandum, we have determined that it is no more than a reiteration of what was on the previous record of 105 pages that was previously transmitted to us. Your objection is noted, and you can continue on, but I can assure you that I find absolutely nothing in there, and I do not mean it to any detriment to opposition, that is persuasive or as in any other means other than what is already on the record. I understand where you're coming from, and nobody wants a level playing field any more than I do. Had you decided to submit a brief that you wanted to go out, that would have been included in the packet. I did not find any fault in including that, and I bear the responsibility for that. But I will tell you, honestly, as a matter of record, I find absolutely nothing in there that was not a reiteration of what was already on the record.
And I hope the chairman understands that I still have to put that on the record.
Your objection is so noted.
And I have a little bit more, and then I'll be finished.
Go ahead.
The board was offered the opportunity this Monday at 4:30 to provide their own arguments to the commission today. The board chose not to do so. The inclusion of the memorandum in the agenda packet is the sort of endorsement that the board cannot overcome. I do not believe that the use of ex parte contact is in my client's best interest. Such an argument is also true about the ex parte contacts that the applicants have extensively used to persuade the commissioners about the rightness of their position prior to this hearing today.
Ms. Wilson, for the record, I've had over 300 emails in opposition to this project go across my BlackBerry all hours of the day or night as well. So from an ex parte perspective, both have been involved in whatever types of negotiation or discussions that we're talking about.
And I would make it clear that the board has not engaged in any ex parte communications. I represent
that is your exact,
the board
you're right.
of the City of Virginia Beach. All the board is asking for is a fair and impartial tribunal to review its decision, one that has not been inundated with arguments from the opposition or the proponents prior to this public forum. We also believe that it should be considered the opening of the record. I know your position on that, Chairman Bowman. However, we believe there is information in the verbatim and the JPA, and that information is not. There is information in the memorandum that is not included in the JPA and in the verbatim transcript. And it's new information packaged as the applicant sees fit. Only the VMRC can open the record, and we would like to have the opportunity, of course, if it is open, to object to its opening. Second, the issue of Mr. Behringer, Nils Behringer, and his participation in the Wetlands Board hearing must be discussed, as the applicant has made it a cause. Mr. Behringer obtained an opinion from the Office of the City Attorney, the correct people to get that opinion from, in regard to whether or not he had a conflict of interest. As he had been involved in discussions with council members and others about the possibility of the city purchasing the property at Pleasure House Point, Indigo Dunes. At the wetlands hearing, counsel for the applicant expressed his concern via a letter, Exhibit 2, I believe. And Mr. Behringer, of his own initiative, placed his opinion from the city attorney in the record. Essentially, the State and Local Government Conflicts of Interest Act is the only arbiter of conflicts in the state. If you're not in violation of the act, there is no conflict. This commission cannot substitute its judgment for the provisions of the act. The act further focuses the only conflict there is in the act is a financial interest of government officers and appointees. Without a financial interest in the property in question, there's no personal interest in the transaction. No requirement to disclose this or to abstain. There is no conflict. It's like asking all of you to come and disclose, I have no conflict. You do not have to disclose unless there's a conflict. Mr. Behringer received a letter from the city attorney saying he had no financial interest. He does not have a conflict. The only interest that matters under the Conflict of Interest Act is a financial interest, not the nebulous personal interest that the applicant would have this commission adopt outside of the Conflicts of Interest Act, actually in contravention of the state law. Mr. Behringer was correct in not disclosing or abstaining from this vote. He did not disclose because there was nothing to disclose. He did not have a financial interest. Further, any issues about the interest of Mr. Behringer should have been addressed to the Commonwealth's Attorney of the City of Virginia Beach, who has the authority, the only one with the authority, to prosecute violations of the Act. So as much has been made of this issue, it should not even be of concern to the Commission. In fact, if Mr. Behringer had abstained, the motion to approve would still not have passed by a 3-3 vote. It is not the policy of the Board to have an alternate for one vote. If Mr. Behringer was not going to be there for the whole day, then an alternate would have sat for Mr. Behringer. However, the board would not have appointed an alternate to vote on this application. But now, it's time to consider the real reasons that we're here today. To determine if the Wetlands Board procedurally erred in their decision of May 21st, 2007. Not whether or not you would have voted differently from the board. Not whether you like or dislike their decision, but whether or not they followed the correct law and procedure. I am here to tell you, along with VMRC staff, that they did not procedurally err in this decision and should be upheld. This commission shall modify, remand, or reverse the decisions of the Wetlands Board if the Wetlands Board, in reaching its decision, failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetlands Zoning Act, or the substantial rights of the appellant have been prejudiced because the findings, conclusions, or decisions of the board are in violation of constitutional provisions, in excess of statutory authority and jurisdiction, unlawful procedure, affected by other errors, unsupported by the evidence, or arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. The Wetlands Board spent considerable time and energy listening to and exploring all of the aspects of this application. They visited the property, read the JPA, which is not a small feat, listened to both the applicant and the opposition before reaching their decision, and then doing so based on the facts and the law. The intent of the Wetlands Act, as stated by the legislature in 1972 and reiterated by the guidelines and by the chairman of the Wetlands Board at this hearing, in order to protect the public interest, promote the public health, safety, and the economic and general welfare of the Commonwealth, and to protect public and private property, wildlife, marine fisheries, and the natural environment, it is declared to be the public policy of this Commonwealth to preserve the wetlands and to prevent their defoliation and destruction and to accommodate necessary economic development in a manner consistent with wetlands preservation. The board's responsibility is to protect the wetlands from defoliation and destruction, and this vote clearly does that, refusing to allow the destruction of these wetlands for this intense housing development. The board's findings are not in violation of the any constitutional provisions. They've not been enumerated by either the applicant or the board in their discussion and deliberation of this application. The only due process considerations that have been raised were ours in opposition to the memorandum today. The board's decision was not in excess of the statutory authority or the jurisdiction of the board. The applicant would have this commission believe that the board made a determination that the wetlands on this property could never be destroyed. However, even taking Chairman Plumlee's statement out of context, as the applicant does, the chairman states that his charge is to protect the wetlands and that he would not destroy them for the mere possibility that their destruction might help water quality. The board understands its obligations under the law and the statutes and follows the criteria found in Section 1408 of the city's Wetlands Zoning Ordinance, which states the board shall grant a permit if, it's a discretionary act of the board, they use their discretion, if they believe that, one, the anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed activity exceeds its anticipated public and private detriment. Even the minority who made the application of the board members wanting to approve this application does not say here that the benefits outweigh the detriments of this project. The proposed development conforms with the standards enumerated in 28.2 1308, which states that the wetlands of primary ecological significance shall not be altered, and talks about development shall be concentrated in wetlands of lesser ecological significance, those that have been irretrievably disturbed before 72, and in non-vegetated wetlands which have been irreversibly disturbed prior to 83, and in areas outside of wetlands. Now, these are the things that shall be considered, as shall the guidelines which have been promulgated pursuant to 1301. The applicant wants to argue that those wetlands that they are disturbing are irretrievably destroyed. However, they also want to say, in questioning before the board about the viability of their compensation and their 6 acres of wetlands, that the wetlands will come back easily because they'll be placed on the remnants of the old marsh, and that there's a mat of old marsh material that will flourish and grow. In fact, they agree that the area was once marsh until it was manipulated by man, a distinction not recognized by the law. Wetlands are wetlands, whether they come about naturally or whether they come about because there has been some kind of manipulation. Either they're destroyed and irretrievably destroyed, or they're still there. The applicant can't have it both. And the guidelines clearly state that the alteration of the shoreline is not justified when the alteration will result in the discharge of effluents which impair wetlands, water quality, or other marine resources. The guidelines do not say that they encourage measures to prevent discharge of effluents which would impair wetlands, water quality, or other marine resources, as is stated throughout the applicant's memorandum. Filling in wetlands or subaqueous areas for the singular purpose of creating waterfront upland property is generally undesirable. Further, high-density development in or immediately adjacent to wetlands and or other floodplains is discouraged. And finally, there is at present no conclusive evidence that the trading of one marine habitat for another results in a net gain for the environment. These are all implications of this project. The board complied with these requirements and did not prohibit any impacts, but could not justify these impacts in accordance with the requirements of Section 1408. In fact, in the only comment that Mr. Barringer makes throughout this five-hour ordeal, he in fact says that there may be a degree of development that could be put on this property. It was not made upon unlawful decision, a lawful procedure, their decision. There's no evidence that the procedure used or followed was in any way unlawful. Council wants to report to Mr. Barringer. We have already been through that discussion. He was within the provisions of the Conflicts of Interest Act and was not unlawful in any manner. There's been no other error of law cited. Now, unsupported by the evidence on the record as considered on the whole. If you read the record, if you read the verbatim, took me hours, the record indicates that the strategy of this applicant was to sell this application with the compensation. You're getting 6+ acres of created wetlands, stormwater systems, oyster reefs, and conservation easements, constantly and consistently harping on all of the compensation that would be given for these man-made bad wetlands. Almost their entire presentation was about the wonderful things that they would do for this property while they completely fill the project and place 1,000 homes. However, such an approach is inconsistent with the provisions of the Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy and was correctly cited by both the opposition in their many letters and in their presentations and the board in its reasons for voting against the motion to approve. The Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy is extremely familiar to the board. In fact, they have been before this commission for not following the provisions of the Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy. They were the first locality that you all had a discussion with about their use of the policy. The Wetlands Mitigation Compensation Policy requires that three criteria be met. The proposed activity should stand on its own merit in the permit approval process. Compensation, those acres of wetlands, the stormwater system, and the oysters, which will be placed in mudflat, cannot be used to justify issuing a permit. The three criteria are that all reasonable mitigative actions, including alternate sitings, which would eliminate or minimize wetlands loss or disturbance, shall be incorporated in the proposal. The board and the opposition did not believe that such an avoidance had been attempted. They were there for the hearing. They did not believe avoidance had been used. The proposal shall clearly be water dependent in nature. A housing development, which is the purpose of this project, its purpose is not to clean up the stormwater in Ocean Park, which is the development up here, in Ocean Park. It's to build 1,000 plus houses, clearly set out in the purpose in its JPA. And third, the proposal shall demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands and its overwhelming public and private benefit. Again, a housing development is not required to be in the wetlands. The purpose of this application, as stated by the applicant in the JPA, was the development of high-density development, not to save the community from stormwater runoff. That was the compensation for the destruction of these wetlands. Such a development does not have to be located near the water nor in the wetlands, and that is exactly what Mrs. Brown, Mr. Behringer, and Dr. Vincent said when they gave their views of the application. There's been no evidence of the avoidance of the wetlands in this project, no reason for it being in the wetlands to begin with. Mr. O'Brien of VIMS so aptly stated, the project must stand on its own merit, separate from this compensation. Dr. Vincent correctly adds that this development is not the cure for the stormwater problems of this area. The actions of the board clearly demonstrated that they obeyed the law, the guidelines, and the requirements of the compensation mitigation policy. There was considerable discussion about the problems of water dependence and the need to be in the wetlands. And the majority of the board agreed with many of the speakers and the letters that were received. There had been no proof that avoidance had been attempted, that this development was water dependent, or that there was a requirement for it to be located in the wetlands feature. To find that the board has procedurally erred, it must have erred in one of the provisions that we've already gone over. There's no constitutional violations. They're within their statutory authority. It's not made upon unlawful procedure. It is supported by the evidence, and it's not arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. This application was fairly debated and voted upon. It should be, according to the law and the guidelines, upheld by this commission. This is not an application that will preserve wetlands. It will create wetlands. That's their compensation for destroying wetlands, not preserving them. Questions?
Questions of council. Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. first is on the issue of the level playing field. It seems to me that even if Mr. Berenger did not have a direct financial interest, as you've argued, in the matter, he was actively engaged in lobbying city council on this issue at the same time that it was before consideration by the Wetlands Board. I mean, isn't every applicant entitled to a fair hearing? And how is his participation not unfair to the applicant?
It is not a violation of the Conflicts Act. The Conflicts Act is only about financial interest. And when the Conflicts of Interest Act was passed by the legislature, it is the only conflicts that exist. It is an exclusive statute. Each board commission does not get to determine how they view conflicts. They wanted a central standard for the state, for all local government and state. Now, I can't say to you that there isn't a reason for this uniformity, and that you understand that. However, it's a personal decision, and it's a personal decision whether or not Mr. Berenger gave the board the letter that he had received, because it says he has no conflict. Now, as far as a fair and level playing field, Mr. Berenger listened to the evidence. He made no comment. They talk about him tainting the board. He made no comment other than at the end when every board member was asked for their views. He did not lead the discussion. He did not lead the applicant or the opposition in any manner. He simply had discussions, which I'm not sure how I see asking about buying this piece of property means he's against the development. I mean, he very well, you know, ask about the city buying this piece of property. That does not equate, in my mind, to have a having a financial interest in any way, shape, and form in the property.
Well, I think just to follow up, certainly a person can be a stakeholder without having a direct financial interest. I mean, if you accept the applicant's claim, it appears that he may have had a dog in the fight. But just to follow up, I have a second question. Do you think the board was justified in considering the buffer impacts that it used in part to justify its decision from a jurisdictional standpoint?
Yes, I do. The buffer issue and how it came about, when they were talking about the survivability of the created wetlands and whether or not this created wetlands required a buffer in order to have a greater survivability. That's where the issue came up, and I believe that was perfectly within their rights and jurisdiction to ask questions about that, since it related back to the wetlands issue.
Thank you.
Further questions? No. I'm Ms. Dawson, Ms. Wilson.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sorry.
Going back to the level playing field issue,
yes,
because it I must tell you, that issue does cause me some concern.
As us.
I've read thoroughly the letter that Mr. Berenger received from the city attorney. No less than a dozen times I've read it to try to glean everything I possibly could get from it. I've also read 28.2.13.13 of the Code of Virginia numerous times as well. And under item F, arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. Arbitrary as defined by Black's Law Dictionary of a judicial decision is founded on prejudice or preference rather than on reason or fact.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, by virtue of the activities that were undertaken prior to the Wetlands Board hearing, even if he does have a letter that states you're exempt from the conflict of interest law because you don't have a financial interest. But isn't it possible for a person to have no such conflict but still make a vote that may be potentially arbitrary?
And I guess my answer to you, Mr. Bowman, is that there is no indication in the record. There's no indication by Mr. Berenger's statements that he in any way was prejudiced by his activity that was to attempt to get the city to buy this piece of property. He acted just as any other citizen of the city of Virginia Beach has a right to act by going to his council member. The state legislature has said you only have a conflict if it's a financial conflict. I know Mr. McCluskey has determined that he would like to abstain, but he didn't have to. And, you know, a financial interest, he got quite a financial windfall here. So I'm having a little problem seeing where this was a prejudice to anyone. Even if Mr. Behringer had not voted, this application still fails.
Well, there's a little bit of an argument to that as well. In the dynamics of debate before commission, as you know, and you've been before many of them very, very capably, I might add, depending on who is on that commission, what their persuasion is or is not, can basically influence the dynamics of the debate. So if you to basically say it would have been that way, when you may have had a strong person on there that felt very strongly and very persuasive, or was very persuasive in their arguments, it may have influenced the board another way where it potentially could have gone in a different direction.
Well, there would have been no replacement for Mr. I mean, I want you to understand that. Mr. Behringer would not have been replaced, okay, even if he abstained. So the dynamics, I'm not as concerned about it, because it would have been the same dynamics that we had, because Mr. Behringer did not make any comment until the end.
Okay. Thank you so very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
I think we'll take about a 10-minute recess, and then we will hear from those individuals that were present at the Wetlands Board. We'll resume at 12:10 promptly. We will now reconvene the Marine Resources Commission. This is the time where those individuals who had spoken at the Wetlands Board can now come and speak. I would ask you to please, and Justin, you need to help me stay on track with this too. I would please ask you to make sure that the comments that you make are those that were contained in the record at the time. Don't deviate from that, so that we can maintain the integrity of this process. So I don't know how you want to come forward, but you've got, Justin, did you want to say?
Commissioner Bowman and members of the commission, it's my understanding that they do have a representative here that will be making their presentation or speech. Is that correct?
No, that would be fine. Okay.
I guess we could find out if there are more before he starts.
Yeah, is there anyone other than this gentleman that wished to speak? And I saw three hands. Four hands.
And I guess we just need to confirm when they come up here that they were present and they spoke at the Wetlands meeting.
Okay.
Heard plenty about
it. Yeah. I think Ms. Wilson has adequately addressed what happened there, what occurred, and.
Well, the applicant kind of mischaracterized the group, so-called group of citizens and their activities. So I was just going to
All right, here's the deal. Four people want to speak. Okay? Is that it? 7.5 minutes apiece, 8 minutes apiece, thereabout. Who's first? It's 12:15 now.
Thank you, Commissioner. My name is Mike Wills. I spoke at the meeting. I just, like I said, I wanted to clarify the...
right hand. Okay. You saw me swear the test. How about I swear everyone in now that's going to speak? If you'd stand, please. You solemnly swear the testimony that you'll give today before this commission will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you very much. Proceed, sir.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify the so-called group that met to consider the raising funds to purchase.
Your name, sir?
Oh, Mike Wills. Sorry, Mike Wills, living in Virginia Beach. The group that I was a part of with Nils and two other individuals was just a group of citizens. We had no specific affiliation with any other group. It was not a group opposed to Indigo Dunes development. It was a group simply brought together in support of the Virginia Beach Open Spaces long-standing objective to purchase Pleasure House Point, but the issue was always money. So we got together, I believe it was around October of 2006, to explore ways to raise money to add resources to the Virginia Beach Open Space Fund in order to purchase the property, because our understanding was it was for sale to for anybody who had $25 million, that was the asking price. We did meet with our council representatives on two occasions to discuss different ideas. And the last meeting we had with them was in late February. At that point, it was brought to our attention that the property had been sold. It was the deal was closed in the middle of February. And from that point on, we basically disbanded, never had another discussion about it amongst ourselves or city council members. And that was the extent of it, was to try to raise funds to support the property when it was for sale.
Okay. Any questions from the commission, the gentleman? Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Who's next? And y'all's a lot of time keeps going up with the short presentations.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
My name's Wally Damon. Thank you for letting me speak.
Pleasure to have you here, sir.
Okay. I did get to speak for just a couple of minutes before the Wetlands Board. And I'm only going to be a couple of minutes this time because there are probably people who know a lot more about the ecosystem than I do.
All right, sir.
I am a 49 or 50-year resident of the Chesapeake Beach section of Virginia Beach. I used to go across Lynn Haven Inlet when there was a flat bridge there, and you know, there wasn't an arch bridge. But I'm an example of somebody who would be opposed to this whale swimming its way up the Lynn Haven River, beaching itself on the Indigo Dunes property there. This is not a minnow of a little house that they're trying to build. This is going to have a major impact on our area. I like to, and I'm an example of someone who would be opposed to it, okay? That I've lived there. I'd like to take canoe trips up and down the waterways there where the oysters are and where the crabs are. I have taken pictures out there. It shows snails on the grasses and, you know, small fish being chased by bigger fish, being chased by monsters. I don't know what they were, but you know, Mr. Nutter was exactly right when he said people shouldn't trespass back there. Nobody should go back there. This place should be left alone. I would very much appreciate you hearing this one small thing. When I went back there and looked at these oyster beds, not only are there oysters back there, but there are thousands of them, and just tens of thousands of small little tiny crabs that big. When you float your canoe up beside these oyster beds, and you get close to looking at these things, and these little crabs, they try to crawl away. They actually make a sound. It sounds like little shells being dropped out of your hand or something like that. And I got real close, and I jumped out there with my hand, and they went shh. They went scattering away. It's something to see. It's something to experience. It's not something to destroy. I've been all over this country, and I've never seen anything like this. This is the only area that we have anything like this. I'm very proud of what the Wetlands Board voted for to stop this. And thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Next.
Questions?
Nope. Questions. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
State your name for the record, please.
Daphne Atkins. And I just wanted to speak today to point out a few of the inconsistencies in the story that are on the record. I'm not bringing up anything that isn't on the record. And also to point out one of the reasons why this application has taken so long, because we were talking about this a year ago, and they were, you know, bringing this before different boards a year ago, Chesapeake Bay Board. But it's because they've made so many mistakes in their attempts at their application that it kept getting sent back. for clarification. Sometimes their numbers didn't line up. Sometimes they used one number on one page and in speaking about the same thing, they used another number on another page. So that's one of the reasons why this has taken so long. But I also want to point out that the opposition's argument against this project centered around the three things you have to prove to destroy wetlands. That's VAC 2390-40, and it outlines three criteria that must be met before the Wetlands Board can authorize a project that will destroy wetlands. If the proposal cannot meet one or more of these criteria, that means you have to meet all three, the activity shall be denied or must occur in areas apart from the wetlands. The three criteria are all reasonable mitigative actions, including alternate siting, which would eliminate or minimize wetlands loss or disturbance, must be incorporated in the proposal. The proposal must be clearly water-dependent in nature, and the proposal must demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands and its overwhelming public and private benefit. In addition, on page 26 of your Wetlands Board meeting information, it refers to subsection A of VMRC's criteria for evaluating alterations to wetlands, and it states that filling wetlands to create waterfront property is generally undesirable. Their purpose for filling the wetlands is to make $500 million on this project because they'll have more land. They can make $500 million instead of, say, only $300 million. And that is the sole purpose of them wanting to fill the wetlands. It has nothing to do with water quality or anything else. And I did want to point out a few inconsistent statements. On page 24 of the Wetlands Board minutes, first of all, before I say that, the applicant states that the wetlands have already been irreversibly disturbed, the ones underneath the spoils. Yet on page 24 of the Wetlands Board minutes, Carl Murdoch says that the material to create the new wetlands is going to come from underneath the spoils. So on the one hand, they're saying it's been irreversibly disturbed, and on the other hand, they're saying that's where they're going to get the stuff to create the new wetlands. They also repeatedly mention a King's Grant, but they have yet to show any information that shows that they do have a King's Grant.
And for what it's worth, Ms. Atkins, this board will not be considering.
Right.
We know that from an informational purpose, but I just want to make it quite clear that that is not part of our consideration during these deliberations.
Well, and part of what I'm trying to show here is that they basically haven't let the truth get in the way of a good story. So on page 91 of the Wetlands Board minutes, they say that the project could be smaller and not alter the wetlands. They say it themselves. That's one of the things they're supposed to, one of the criteria that they're supposed to meet, and they're saying they could make it smaller. So on page 82 of the Wetlands Board's minutes, in his rebuttal, Mr. Nutter says in one paragraph that there are no turtles on the property, and yet in the next paragraph where he's speaking, he says that people and their dogs are going back there and stepping on the turtle eggs. So he's saying there aren't turtles, but then there are turtle eggs, and I don't know how these eggs mysteriously got back there, but that's one of the points that he's saying. One other thing I wanted to point out was there's been a lot of talk about Mr. Barringer, but there was also Mr. Ripley's vote that you have. If that's of any importance to you, you have Mr. Ripley's vote. And Mr. Ripley's reasoning for voting for the project was because that any house on the water in Virginia Beach was water dependent. No house is water dependent. The water is a perk. You know, it's a bonus, but it's not water dependent. A marina is water dependent. They also talk about a 21-acre linear park that they mention. And the 21-acre linear park is actually the 100-foot buffer that the Chesapeake Bay Act says that you have to leave. So it's not like they're giving us anything. That's just something that they're throwing in. And on a lighter note, the final misstatement that they made on page 9 was Mr. Nutter refers to his client, Art Sandler, as Adam Sandler. That was my favorite. One's a real estate developer, one's on Saturday Night Live.
Freudian slip.
Thank you,
Ms. Atkins. Who's next? Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Chairman Bowman and distinguished commission members. I'm the last speaker tonight. I'll keep my speech brief also. I know we've been here a while. However, it wasn't quite the 5.5 hours that we had to sit through at the Wetlands Board hearing. My name is Todd Solomon, for the record. I live in Virginia Beach, and I'm here as a representative of the Shore Drive Community Coalition. As a result of participating in this project's review process over the past year, the community has gained a better understanding and respect for the importance of the Commission and the Wetlands Board responsibilities. We have learned that the decisions made by these groups are difficult and rely heavily on a detailed understanding of the many city and state codes. On May 21st, the Virginia Beach Wetlands Board displayed a solid understanding of their responsibility and a firm grasp of the codes and standards as they pertain to this particular project. The 5.5 hour hearing provided ample time for the community representatives, all 27 of us, to express their points. During this hearing, the board members asked poignant questions, quoted applicable regulations, and expressed in detail how these regulations pertain to this project. One of the most important codes, which has been brought up several times today and discussed by multiple board members during the hearing, was 4 VAC 20 TAC 390 TAC 40, the code that requires, in order for a proposal to be authorized to destroy wetlands, three criteria must be met. The third criteria in this code states, the proposal shall demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands. This is the first step in the process of going through all the other stipulations where you can violate or do other various mitigation projects. We gloss over it, Mr. Nutter does when he first speaks about it, already assuming that we can already fill those and destroy those wetlands. I would make sure that this project does not show the need or the benefit at this time that they need to fill in these wetlands. The project can be made smaller, as Daphne has pointed out, and it's also on page 91 of your verbatim transcript, when Mr. Vincent, Mr. Plumlee, and Mr. Miller, the board members, asked the applicant whether or not a smaller development could be built on this property and still mitigate its stormwater management. So that, as far as we're concerned, has not been met. It has to meet all three of those codes, as you well know. This one has not been met, so therefore it should not be allowed. Prior to calling for the vote on May 21st, at the end of the hearing, each board member identified how they planned to vote and explained why they were going to vote that way. This, in our opinion, leaves no question on how the board members made their decision and, in our opinion, eliminates the possibility of any prejudice to the proceedings. Taking all of this into account, the community agrees with the VMRC staff and the City of Virginia Beach evaluations that the Virginia Beach Wetland Board's vote on May 21st did not violate the VAC 28.2 TAC 1313, and we formally request that this vote be upheld.
Any questions of Mr. Solomon? Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. Were you sworn previously? Raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self you God?
I do.
Wait a second. I've got it. Who are you with, sir?
My name is Carl Mertig. One of the members of the opposition characterized the statement I made at the hearing. I was speaking at the hearing.
Let's just okay. Mr. Nutter?
Mr. Martigue is a representative of the applicant.
Okay.
And apparently was trying to rebut one of the statements made by us.
We're still in the time frame of those individuals that spoke in support. Is there anyone here that is in opposition to the project that spoke at the Wetlands Board that'd like to clarify and verify their statement before the commission? Yes, sir.
The bathroom and
swear it in. Come on around. It happens from time to time. I do it so many times, I do it in my sleep. Do you solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give be the truth, the whole truth, and none but the truth, self you God?
I do.
Thank you, sir. Would you state your name, please?
My name is Larry Connor. I'm the president of the Bay Lake Pine Civic League. And I'll say the same thing I said at the other hearing. You see, this is all covered with trees, and the pictures that we've been seeing, it's all covered with houses, a building. In other words, we're substituting trees for concrete. And when you got concrete with cars parked there, there's runoff from oil and other type of runoff, And all this is going into the water. There's no way to keep it from going into the Pleasure House Creek. And I think we're going to kill the creek when we do this. And that's going to affect the Lynn Haven Inlet and after that. And that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you, sir. Any questions to the gentleman? Thank you very much. Okay, I see no one else desiring to use the remainder of the time that was allotted. We will now then go to the applicant's rebuttal and summary.
Mr. Commissioner, would you give me 1 minute? I want to try to incorporate some of Mr. Martek's comments. So we
yes, sir.
I apologize.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate your indulgence. As anything of this size, there's any number of things you can talk about, so I will try to be very brief in my rebuttal today. I'd first like to talk about the conflict of interest issue, which I'd like to just respond to Kay's comments. My concern with that is that the statute requires that you disclose that situation. His decision was a personal decision, but he didn't disclose it, and that reflects poorly on the process, poorly on the board, and does affect my client's rights. For the same reasons, Mr. Commissioner, you cited, that fact alone prejudices that person's decision, ability to proceed directly, and that, by inherent law, that, in fact, undermines the process and my client's rights. Just that alone. Secondly, we played with the issue a little bit. Well, would it have made a difference, Mr. Robbins, you made that point a little bit, if had he voted? Two things on that. Number one, I don't think that the conflict of interest problem is absolved because two people didn't have a conflict of interest and failed to meet the act. The conflict of interest applies when one person does it, not two. And so I would urge you not to look to do just, I think, what you did, Mr. Commissioner, and that is if there's a person on there whose decision is prejudiced, then the process is tainted and the board's decision is undermined. And more importantly, my client's interests are undermined and not protected, and that's exactly what the statute says and exactly what it says. The second thing that Kay brought to your attention was the fact that, wait a minute, she says, we wouldn't have appointed an alternate anyway. Well, that would have been a prejudice that we would have objected to at the hearing because we were required to have we had a majority of the members appointed by the commission, so we would have requested a deferral had we known that, to make sure someone was there who in fact could vote on the application, because otherwise we were being denied a full board. And with the statutory requirement of a given number of people regardless of a conflict, we would be entitled to that, in my opinion. So I don't think that is any worth notion other than that, but I would tell you that by its very nature, it impinges the decision of the board. It denies my client, by inherent reason, a full impartial hearing by people who have not formed an opinion in advance of that. As to the gentleman who spoke about his interest, first of all, the record is complete, and the record shows very clearly an email that he sent to counsel attempting to raise funds. This gentleman, while he extrapolated on that, and I didn't object in the record, but it points out that he, in fact, says, we were raising money to buy this property. He had a direct, immediate pecuniary interest at that point in time. That point in time alone. And that was from the statement that was not in the record. I was relying only on the email. So it's a very serious matter, ladies and gentlemen, not just for my client, but for the interest of the board and the interest of the Commonwealth. The second point I'd like to talk about is a considerable issue has been made about the fact that these areas were irreversibly impacted. First, let me tell you, they're only quoting from part of the statute. The statute goes on to say, as you probably are all too familiar, that if you have wetlands impacts, you should concentrate them in, quote, in wetlands of lesser ecological significance. That's just, you could have done that without even having been irreversibly impacted. It also says you can also do them in vegetative wetlands which have been irreversibly disturbed prior to 72. There's no question these wetlands were irreversibly disturbed prior to that time, and I'll tell you why. Because in the JPA, you will find the disturbance of the property in this question. The sand was placed so deep that the marsh is well below the location of the ditches on this property and well below where these wetlands are located on the property. So I can tell you that the wetlands that were irreversibly disturbed were indeed under these areas. And more importantly, though, that you concentrate those efforts where they have lesser ecological significance. The reason for the testimony, by the way, about the areas where we in our mitigation areas, because the opposition was saying you can never, a man-made wetland can never be as good as a natural wetland. And we presented significant evidence at the commission hearing, you know, in the photographs are here today, of a variety of man-made wetlands throughout Hampton Roads that are thriving, doing wonderfully, in some of the nicest facilities. In fact, one of them is the Virginia Beach Marine Science Museum, today the Virginia Aquarium. Is a man-made wetland that's just pristine as the devil. It's on the records and your photographs right here. We presented that to show that, number one, it can be done, and number two, that underneath this area, we would be restoring that. So I don't let them mislead the record here on that issue. Those areas are, quite frankly, were disturbed. Those areas are of less ecological value, and that's uncontradicted in the evidence, uncontradicted. That's where the impacts are. And that, and the other thing I want to point out, quite frankly, is they keep saying we didn't avoid and minimize. 86% of the wetlands on this site, 86% are untouched by this application. 86%. That's an incredible record. And the wetlands that are impacted are all either inundated by Phragmites or there as a result of their opportunistic growth along this ditch. This is served by stormwater, not by the tidal influence of this water. Now, one last thing. The point that Mr. Martig wanted me to raise, and he's a very passionate gentleman about this issue. He was asked by the chairman, and this is in the record as well, could you build a smaller development on this property? And, of course, the answer in any situation is yes. And that isn't the issue before that board anyway, by the way. But he then asked, could you do the stormwater for the property without impacting those wetlands? And his answer was no. My point to you is that regardless of the size of the development on this property, the ditches that infected here and the stormwater running through them, we have to deal with regardless. The density issue, which is not before this board, not before the local board, as you know, that issue will be left to a subsequent council. But I can tell you, by law, we are required to treat and deal with stormwater coming through this site. We cannot do that unless we disturb those ditches, because we have to rechannel it. If we rechannel the water out of those ditches, those facilities will die. Those wetlands will die. They're served solely by the water coming through those features. So what we channel to do instead is just do the right thing, which, and by the way, they serve no BMP purpose today. They're just a ditch. Is to take those and create a BMP where they can be preserved and relocate these low-quality wetlands into the high-quality features around the perimeter. That's what this is really all about. And by the way, that is not the ends justifying the means. That's exactly what they would have you believe. Those features, we would have had to impact those wetlands regardless of the development of this property, because we could not treat the stormwater any other way. And the Phragmites, quite frankly, 80%, we would have had to deal with that issue regardless of what happened. The mitigation that we have put back is because we believe that the wetlands on this property should be put back in a high-value position and should be a critical component of this water-dependent development. This is a major piece of property on the water, surrounded on water by three sides. To say that development of this property is not water-dependent is, quite frankly, misleading. We have to deal with it. We have Chesapeake Bay features. just like the commission members talked about. But my point to you about the water dependency nature is, and this is a legal argument, I'll pause for a moment to tell you that, is that the opposition is relying entirely upon the regulation that they cite to you. The regulation that they cite to you, number one, it cites for its source that its basis in law is pursuant to 28.2103 and 28.21301. Neither of those statutes mentions the word water dependent. The only time water dependency is raised in this process is in the Chesapeake Bay Act features, when in fact water dependency is a possible exemption from the 100-foot buffer issue. That's point number one. So the regulation has serious question in my mind about ties to water dependency. The second part I'd make to you, however, is that your guidelines, which we talk about, also do not reflect water dependency. As I've mentioned to you, they were applied by the board in this case because they treated this as a shoreline development. Now, as I've told you earlier, those are non-navigable features. They are blocked from the river by a pipe system. They are not shoreline features. And therefore, the whole concept of applying a water dependency activity to an upland ditch is wrong. And finally, I'll tell you why I believe this, we had a debate about this, Mr. Chairman, in the record. And I told them that I said, well, tell me why then stormwater isn't water dependent if we have to alter the stormwater system that goes in here. Clearly, stormwater treatment is a water dependent activity. And our desire, frankly, in this case, to actually improve the wetlands around this area and make them a part of this development makes this a water-dependent activity. So my point to you is that I question the legality of that regulation, number one. Number two, the state statute, by the way, which supersedes any regulation, the state statute sets forth the test as we went over, and that is that we have the public-private benefits outweigh the public-private detriments. That we comply with the guidelines, by the way, not the regulations, but the guidelines, which we do, and that we comply with the intent of the Act, which is to mirror between economic development and preservation of wetland and water quality in the state. So I'm happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman, you might have, or Commissioner, forgive me, or you or your members.
Questions of Mr. Nutter?
No.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
The matter is before the Commission for discussion and action.
Commissioner?
Yes, Mr. Schick.
I'd like to say that I see that the size of this development is definitely on a large scale. And I understand the concern of the locality. And the Commonwealth in general on any type of development that's on this scale. But the upland development is not the core issue. The core issue is the wetlands and the affected wetlands. The buffer zone from the Chesapeake Bay Act areas are not an issue of this wetlands. The issues are, again, the wetlands in question. These wetlands were completely and utterly obliterated by man-made features and made into a dysfunctional ecosystem. And to preserve a dysfunctional ecosystem for the sake of preservation is a misjustice of the thoughts of preservation. If you want to preserve something, you have to have it functional. That have something to preserve. The owners of this property have every right to develop it within the law. And I just am very troubled by the fact that good government didn't take precedence here and find out how that the owners of this property and the citizens of the Commonwealth of Virginia can be served. And that is what troubles me here.
Mr. Tanker?
I don't really think that's the question at hand here today. I think really we have the question at hand, which is in the code 28.2-1313. states the commission shall modify, remand, or reverse the decision of the Wetlands Board if the Wetlands Board in reaching this decision failed to fulfill its responsibilities under the Wetland Zoning Ordinance, number one. Number two, the substantial rights of the appellant or the applicant have been prejudiced because the findings, conclusions, or decisions of the Board are A, in violation of constitutional provisions, B, in excess of statutory authority or jurisdiction of the Wetlands Board, made upon unlawful procedure, affected by other error of law, unsupported by the evidence of the record considered as whole, or F, arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. Therefore, I move that we uphold the Board's decision as we have it before us.
Is there a second to the motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Robbins.
Point of clarification, I would just ask if we could consider having some more discussion prior to taking any motions.
Motion has been made. What I will do is this, is I will rule that the discussion can continue. However, since the motion has been made, I will allow Mr. Tankard the first opportunity to make the motion after discussion is completed. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could say a few things. I think Mr. Tankard has summed up some of the questions of code for us that we need to consider. But just sitting back and looking at this case as we have been for a while now, I think the role of government here is to essentially delimit what impacts are acceptable and which ones are not. The site includes a very high-value Spartina marsh ecosystem that I think warrants careful consideration. I think, in all fairness to the applicant, they did an exceptional job of preserving that fringe marsh, and that is certainly the highest value, highest functioning wetland on the property. I think they took remarkable care in trying to avoid any impacts and limit them to only what was absolutely necessary, really, to treat the stormwater effluent discharge. I think they did a great job of that. The application also demonstrates the need to impact the wetlands related to the dewatering ditches and retention ponds being necessary in order to properly treat the stormwater from the adjacent neighborhood and Indigo Dunes. I think some of the board members rightly concluded that you can't separate that issue. In other words, the stormwater is coming across the property, and that has to be dealt with. And the application steps up and deals with that in a responsible way. I think that's one example of where the impacts were totally justified. And they went through the stepwise process that's contemplated by the various codes and ordinances. I think all the ordinances contemplate a process whereby you avoid, justify, concentrate any impacts in the lowest value wetlands that were possibly disturbed pre-1972. And finally, you compensate. And I think those components, which are major components of this application, were done extremely well. And I think the stormwater improvements will substantially improve water quality, and I think there's ample record evidence of that. However, I think certain portions of the application, and the board pointed this out, didn't fully avoid or justify the direct impacts to wetlands, particularly at the eastern side of the site. I think there were also substantial buffer impacts that were not avoided or clearly justified. While some of those buffer impacts may be adjacent to the Wetlands Board immediate jurisdiction, I think there is record evidence that they bear directly on the survivability and protection of the property's high-value fringe marsh. I think the fact that there is a functional continuum between the tidal wetlands and the buffer is pretty well established in Vims's comment. I think ultimately the board's responsibility is to delimit which impacts are and are not acceptable. I think on balance, this was an application that had a lot of merit, was done responsibly, but had some residual concerns with respect to its impacts. And quite frankly, I think good government deals directly with those residual problems in a case like that. And I think it would have been I think those impacts that some board members found to be unacceptable would have been better addressed by conditions.
but they were not. And so we're left as a commission now to consider our appellate role in the case. And as Mr. Tankard pointed out, we have to have a solid record basis for overturning or remanding a decision. And as I look at it, I think the board appropriately considered factors in the code. I think some of what they did was didn't exactly deal with the problems in a constructive way, but they did consider the code correctly, and I think there was a reasonable basis for their decision. I think just looking through the potential bases for reversal or remanding, one issue that really sticks out in my mind is the conflict of interest issue. I have a hard time believing that the applicant got a fair hearing on a basic level, and yet I have a hard time with the code making that leap from the sense that what was done was somehow inappropriate to actually prejudicing the rights of the applicant, in that there is no legal provision, as I understand the code, for replacing that individual with an alternate had he recused himself. And consequently, I have a hard time justifying that basis, I suppose, for any action other than affirming the decision.
Further comment? Mr. Fox?
I like Mr. Schick and Mr. Tankard, Mr. Robbins, agree that the applicant made a very strong case and has a, to my mind, a very attractive project. But when I look at it, it seems to me that it's not what I or we think about the project or the decision, but solely per Code Section 28.2.13.13, we have to analyze the decision of the board and determine whether it should be upheld or remanded. Looking through that, I am persuaded by the arguments of staff that were presented to us this morning, and also in the record, staff making the argument that the actions of the Wetlands Board were appropriate in that they considered the code, and they considered basically the things they were supposed to consider. And so I'm comforted by the fact that was in fact done in an acceptable manner. I worry a little bit about Mr. Berenger's potential conflict. I understand from the Code of Virginia that a conflict of interest is defined as a financial conflict, and other conflicts, other elements of conflict are not relevant. I also am persuaded by reading through the document that Mr. Berenger really didn't have much influence, didn't appear to have much influence in the meeting itself, although I will acknowledge that from his outside associations, it would appear that his decision on how he was going to vote was perhaps determined before he came into the meeting. But he did not apparently try to influence the decision of others through his comments at the meeting. But I guess when you get back to Mr. Schick's arguments about what would be good government, I guess I am disappointed that we don't have a project here that the Virginia Beach Wetlands Board could find acceptable in some form, whether it's this form, which they did not find acceptable, but perhaps some modified form that they in the future may find acceptable. And I would hope that there would be some opportunity for the regardless of what the decision is here today, that maybe the applicant can make modifications, and I do not want to define any modifications because that's not my role, but perhaps to come up with a project that would be acceptable to the Virginia Beach Wetlands Board and to the other boards that must approve this. But again, getting back to what I'm I guess controlled by is did the Wetlands Board live within 28.2.13.13, and it appears to me that they have.
Further comment?
Commissioner, I do have a little bit more, if I may. I don't think that the board took into account the full evidence that was provided to them. I think they were swayed by areas that were outside of their jurisdiction. I think they were swayed by information that was provided that is not germane to the wetlands that they're supposed to be looking at. And I feel that that basically they did not key on the main area that this property here is not pristine wetlands, that it is dysfunctional ecosystem, and it was disturbed prior to 72. And that should have been one of the foremost discussion matters in the minutes, and it was not. It was barely mentioned. This property needs a lot of help, and there could be a lot worse developments that could come to this property that may pass the standards that this Wetlands Board has set. And I think that basically that this should be overturned.
Further comment? Well, this situation is certainly a complicated case, and I think it requires extreme discipline on behalf of the commission to make sure that we, as a commission, examine what we're required to examine today, and that is set out under the Code of Virginia in 28.2.13.13. We may think this is the best case in the world. We may think it's the worst case in the world. However, that specific, those observations are not particularly relevant unless you believe that the decision by the Virginia Beach Wetlands Board was unsupported by evidence on the record considered as a whole or arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion. I also share some sincere concerns about the level playing field that's been discussed today. But then again, as it's been explained and has not been contradicted by counsel, that apparently there was no violation of the law. So where we are is, did the Wetlands Board fulfill their responsibilities under the Wetlands Board ordinance? I think there are a lot of potential benefits to this project. I think that the stormwater treatment, the recycling, for lack of a better term, of the dysfunctional ecosystem, all of the good things that could come from this project when compared to the amount of wetlands that would be impacted. I mean, we're talking about 1.5 acres of wetlands versus 4.1 mitigation. I think the benefits of the project clearly override the detriments that are there. And I believe that pursuant to Section E, that the decision of the Wetlands Board was unsupported by the evidence on the record considered as a whole. That's my personal opinion. Now, the matter is before the Commission for action. Mr. Tankard.
You've heard my motion. Should I repeat? Or?
Yes, sir.
Pursuant to Code Section 28.2-1313, I think that we should support the decision made by the Wetlands Board of Virginia Beach.
Motion made by Mr. Tankard. Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second.
Second by Mr. Fox.
I'd like to provide a substitute motion.
Substitute motion is now on the table. Mr. Schick.
I move based on Chapter 13, 28.2-1313, specifically unsupported by evidence on the record and considered as a whole or arbitrary and capricious or an abuse of discretion, that we vote to overturn the Wetlands Board of Virginia Beach in this decision dealing with Sandler at Indigo Bay, LLC.
Is there a second to the motion?
I second.
Second by Mr. Holland. Mr. Bowden?
Aye.
Mr. Fox?
We're voting on the substitute.
We're voting on the substitute motion to reverse the decision.
No.
Mr. Holland?
Aye.
Dr. McConaughey is absent. Mr. McCluskey is absent. Mr. Robbins?
No.
Mr. Schick?
Aye.
Mr. Tankard?
No.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-3. Thank you very much for your presentations today.
Are we to eat lunch here, sir?
If you want to. Lunch is ready.
Within our
meeting's adjourned.
I want you to stop again.